Welcome to today's program titled Nuts and Bolts and Q&A, Washington's Paid Family and Medical Leave. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen, so please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to turn it over to Kate Tiley-Hirth. You may begin.
Thank you, and good morning. So to kick off, we're going to start with an overview of paid family medical leave. Before we get started, a few housekeeping items. One, CLE credit is currently pending and should be available next week and will be distributed to the attendees. Two, if you're looking, trying to find your credit information, it is going to be stored under handouts on your screen. So if you look at conference materials, there's a tab for presentation and a tab for handouts, and it will be available under there. To give a little sense of how we're doing today's format, it's going to be a little different. Some of you may have attended our webinars in the past, so some of this information you may have heard before in a slightly different format. We found value from our own experience as well as talking with clients that there was an interest in having really a nuts and bolts session to go over PFML in general and then dive into more of the complicated questions that we've been receiving. So in advance of today, we had asked participants to submit questions at the time of registration. We did receive over 200 questions from today's attendees. So in preparation, we reviewed them, organized them by subject matter, and have tried to condense it down to cover as many as possible. Obviously, given time constraints, we can't get to 200 questions, although we love PFML and could sit here all day going over questions, but we all probably don't want to spend our whole day that way. So we'll go ahead and get started. And then also, if you have questions that come up during the presentation, feel free to submit them. Again, we may not be able to get to them, but we'll try to incorporate them as much as possible. So to start off for today's presentation, we'll go over an overview of PFML. We'll look at how it intersects with other leave laws. I would say the majority of the questions we have been getting recently are how PFML intersects specifically with FMLA, but also with the WLAD and different disability-related leaves, as well as Washington Family Care Act. And so we'll look at some of those intersections in getting us all ready for 2020. As many of you know, there's still ongoing rulemaking by ESD at this time. There's a lot of questions we're receiving about topping off and how supplemental benefits work. And then also we have Christine Hawkins with our benefits group with us today to go over some of the more specific benefits related issues. And then we'll spend about 45 minutes with the overview, and then we'll go into the Q&A session, which again is divided by topic. We have our special guest, Jason Barrett from ESD, attending with us today. So he will be answering some of those Q&As and may jump in during the presentation as well. So a special thank you to Jason for joining us from ESD. To start off with the overview, really going back to the basics on this, what is PFML? PFML, as we all probably know at this time, is a Washington state-specific insurance plan that requires employers to report wages, hours worked, and additional information quarterly. So as we know, the deduction started January 1, 2019. There was there was a little bit of a delay in the reporting, and so the reporting for the first quarters got pushed to fall time, but now my understanding is we are on that quarterly schedule moving forward. PFML is funded by premiums that are paid both by employees and larger employers. And so any employer that has 50 or more employees in the state of Washington is considered a large employer, and those employers are also required to make a contribution to the PFML program. Premium collection started back on January 1, and then as we know, people can start applying for PFML on January 1, 2020, so we have 27 more days is the countdown until PFML officially goes into effect. In general, eligible employees will receive up to 12 weeks of partial wage reimbursement for qualified leave, And in some situations, that can extend up to 16 weeks, and that would be a situation in which an employee has both a medical leave, so their own serious health condition, as well as care for a specific family member with a serious health condition. That'll take them up to 16 weeks leave in a calendar year. And then 18 weeks is going to extend out if the employee has a pregnancy-related complication that results in incapacity, such as being on bed rest. So who must comply with PFML? Most employers that have any employees in the state of Washington must participate in the program. There are some exceptions. Federal employees are not covered. Federally recognized tribes may opt in to the program if they choose to do so, as well as self-employed individuals. And some employees that are covered by collective bargaining agreements are not currently covered by PFML, but they will likely be in the near future. And I'll go over that in a little more detail as far as what to do with the CBA-covered employees. But back to kind of who it does cover, if an employer has, 500 employees outside the state of Washington and has one person in the state of Washington, they're going to be covered for purposes of that one employee. Or myself, personally, we have a part-time nanny. She's covered by PFML. So employers of all size, even if you have one employee in the state of Washington, you're going to be covered. Who is eligible? And so for those of you who have been subjected to FMLA, this is FMLA-ish as far as what it looks like with job protection, job restoration, and benefits continuation. But the eligibility is where we see kind of a move away from what we are used to under the FMLA. So an employee is eligible for PFML if they've worked at least 820 hours for any employer in Washington during the qualifying period. And this could be multiple part-time jobs at the same time. So an employee could have three part-time jobs if their hours pieced together are at least 820 hours in the qualifying period, they're going to be eligible to take the leave. The qualifying period, you'll look at the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters or the last four quarters from the day the leave begins. And so an issue could come up for you employers who have individuals that submit a notice that they're going to take PFML starting, say, January 1, 2020. What if the bulk of those 820 hours are in that fourth quarter of 2019. So that quarter hasn't been reported to ESD since the reporting remains open through January of 2020. And so when they apply, there could be a situation in which it doesn't look like they have enough hours. In that situation, if ESD needs to know that fourth quarter, they'll contact you, the employer, to get that information. And so just being aware that, particularly with the program just getting going, that there could be a situation in which ESD is going to need to contact you ahead of the reporting period at the end of January. Okay, so we'll go over a couple of examples. And these are going to be covered in the Q&A as well, but we think it's always helpful to hear things more than once. And these are questions we're getting quite a bit right now. So let's start with the first one. Employee gives birth in March 2019, so she's already given birth and has a child. She took her full FMLA leave in 2019 and has returned to work. Can she take PFML in 2020? And the answer, as it states here, is likely yes. So what will ESD do in this situation? We'll go back, look at the eligibility. Has the person worked 820 hours in the qualifying period? And if they have, they are eligible to take PFML in 2020. They meet that eligibility requirement if it's within 12 months of the birth or placement of the child. And so in this situation, let's say the employee gave birth March 1st of 2019, they're going to be eligible for PFML from January 1 through February 29th. I think we're on a leap year next year. So they'd be eligible up until that period of when they gave birth, so kind of accounting backwards to the 12 months. So that's that scenario. If somebody does give birth in 2019, being aware that they're likely eligible, assuming they meet the other eligibility requirements. Another question that we're getting is, So we'll go over the second example. Employee has a sibling who's going through chemotherapy. Sibling's chemotherapy will continue into 2020. Can your employee take PFML to care for his sibling in 2020? So in this one, it's a little bit different than what you think of under your FMLA. You know, this would not be a qualifying event under the FMLA because it's care for a sibling. However, as we'll get into in a little bit, there's an expanded version of family member under PFML. And so this person would be eligible. A sibling is an eligible family member. Chemotherapy treatment of cancer is going to be a serious health condition. And, you know, with this example, it looks like it'd be a request for intermittent PFML in 2020. Because the treatment is continuing into 2020, yes, this employee, assuming they've worked at 820 hours in the qualifying period, they would be likely eligible to take PFML in 2020 to care for the sibling, even though the health condition started in 2019. And we'll go over a little more detail on that with our intersection of leave clause as well as the Q&A. Okay, so what about unions? I touched on this briefly, but there are going to be exceptions, which I'm sure a lot of you on the phone know, that some employees covered by a CBA are not going to be covered by PFML starting January 1, 2020. And what the test is to see if a CBA employee is covered is employees that are subject to a collective bargaining agreement that was in effect before October 19, 2017 are not required to comply until the CBA expires, is reopened, or renegotiated. So if you have a CBA in effect, and it's been in effect since before the October 19, 2017, and it doesn't expire, hasn't been reopened, hasn't been renegotiated, those employees are not going to be covered by PFML until that triggering event takes place. And then once the CBA does expire, does reopen, is renegotiated, that's a triggering event, and then as an employer, you're required to notify ESC that that has happened, and then the employees would be eligible for PFML. So what is covered under PFML? And this the qualifying event does align with FMLA, so it would be for an employee's own serious health condition or the serious health condition of an eligible family member. It'd be caring for a family member with a serious health condition, and it would also extend to bonding in the first 12 months after adoption, birth, or fostering a child under 18 years, as well as certain military-connected events. The definition of family member is expanded beyond what the FMLA is. It would include children, which are covered by the FMLA, parents, spouses, siblings, grandparents, grandchildren, parents-in-law, grandparents-in-law, and really that would also include siblings-in-law. And so definition of family member, we see that expansion, and so there'll be certain situations in which you may have an employee who it could run concurrently with FMLA, say it's baby bonding. That's going to run concurrently with FMLA because it'd be FMLA covered as well as PFML covered. But there could be situations where, say, a person cares for their spouse and they take their FMLA and then they have a qualifying event under PFML, and it would not necessarily run concurrently. So there are going to be situations in which an employee is covered under PFML, but it does not align with an FMLA-covered absence. How does it work? So what happens when an employee wants to take PFML? So first, for you as an employer, it's important to note that employees must generally give notice to you as the employer at least 30 days before the expected start date of the PFML. You probably know my word generally in there, so of course there's going to be exceptions. But let's say, for example, somebody has had a surgery scheduled for 6 months, they scheduled it for January 1st, probably January 2nd given the holiday, because they know about PFML, and they've known about the surgery for 6 months. It is reasonable to assume they could give you 30 days notice. So in the event they don't, so using that example, in the event that they don't give you sufficient notice, the full 30 days, what ESD has said is that they would then reduce the award. So say the person would normally be approved for 6 weeks, they only gave you 2 weeks notice, so ESD will say, okay, you should have given them 2 weeks more notice, you will be awarded for 4 weeks PFML. And so there would be that deduction if the employee objects to it. Otherwise, they'll just give them the full 6 weeks if there's not an objection by the employer on the notice period. Of course, there's going to be situations in which the leave is unforeseeable. For example, say an employee's in a really bad car accident. Usually you're not going to be able to give 30 days notice if you're going to be in a car accident. So in that situation, that would be considered unforeseeable. An employee would be required to give you whatever notice they can of their intent to take PFML. And second, the employee must file the initial claim with ESD. Again, they must meet certain eligibility requirements, minimum hours work qualifying event. And so the next step after they notify you is that they need to then go create an account on the ESD system, fill out the initial application. My understanding from what's currently available is that setting up the account for the employee is expected to take about 30 minutes. And then once the account is set up, filling out the application, I believe the current guidance is anywhere from 30 minutes to about 2 hours. So there is some time with setting up the account, with getting the initial application in, and then submitting that to ESD. There's really no way for ESD to currently know what to expect come January 1. As we all know, this is a new program. So the goal is to, of course, get these approved as quickly as possible, but there's understandably, if there's a huge number of submissions at the start of the year, it will take some time to get those through and get them approved. Then third, ESD will send the employee her first benefit payment within 14 calendar days after the first properly completed weekly application is received by ESD. So we have the initial application, and then there's an approval process with that. After that's approved, then the employee must submit a weekly application. Once that's properly completed, that's what's going to then trigger the benefit payment. A question that's come up with a lot of employers recently is, I was told by ESD that I'm not going to get any information about my employee's leave, or, you know, what information is going to be provided. And one of a very recent change by ESD, which we think is great, is that an employer is now defined as an interested party. What does that mean? It means that when an employee gets notice from ESD about their leave, about how long it's going to be, about whether or not it's approved, and about what their weekly amount's going to be, when that gets sent to the employee, it gets sent to you. So you're an interested party. So you're going to know what their benefit amount is, how many weeks they're approved for, which is really important as an employer, particularly if you're planning on offering supplemental benefits, so that you know what award they're getting and how much you should be providing in supplemental benefits to top them off, get them to that full pay. Okay. I should have really put 7-day waiting period in quotation marks, because the waiting period might not always be 7 days. So we have a waiting period for all leaves except for birth or placement of a child. So if there's a birth or placement of a child, that leave does not have a waiting period. But for all other leaves, there is a 7-day waiting period before the employee is eligible for PFML. But the waiting period may not always be 7 days. And this is kind of a moving target right now with the waiting period. We're still in the rules phase of this piece, but the current guidance from ESD on the waiting period is that the waiting period, the week will end on Saturday, the week will start on Sunday. So if I am absent on a Monday, that's my first day, let's say I am in a car accident, that's my first day out of the office, Monday to Sunday, that's going to be my waiting period, so it's going to be 6 days. Let's say I don't get in my car accident. I'm apparently not a very good driver in my scenario. Let's say I get in a car accident on Friday, though. So my waiting period then is only going to be until Sunday, so it could be less than 7 days. because the waiting period is going to always end the end of Saturday. The week of benefits will start that next Sunday. So that has been a little bit of a moving issue, but that's the current guidance that's been put out by ESD, and we'll wait to kind of see how that all plays out. And then assuming ESD approves that application, ESD pays the benefit direct to the employee, and then the minimum claim duration payment is currently 8 consecutive hours. So an employee, if they're, say they're approved on an intermittent leave basis, they must take the at least an 8-hour increment of time for even the intermittent leave. What about my job and my benefits? So what is the FMLA intersection? And I touched on this briefly as far as, if a leave aligns with FMLA, so say baby bonding, that can run concurrently with FMLA. Right to reinstatement, and this is an issue with the right to job restoration as well as benefits continuation. This also is still in draft rules, and so our understanding is there will be further guidance coming out next week about this. But the right to reinstatement, if an employer, and this is where it's a little different than FMLA, if an employer has at least 50 employees in Washington, so that's where we're going to see a little bit of a divergence from the FMLA, which has the 50 employees within a 75-mile radius of the job site. So this expands it to, if there's 50 employees in Washington, that's going to fall under the job restoration benefits continuation portion of the law. The employee has to work for you as the employer for at least 12 months and work for you for at least 1,250 hours in the preceding year. And so we are going to see a difference in PFMLA eligibility as far as the 820 hours work for any employer versus the job restoration and benefits, which aligns pretty closely with the FMLA with the exception of 50 employees in the state versus 50 employees in the 75-mile radius. Benefits continuation question mark. Again, we're hoping to get more guidance on that. Christine will touch briefly on kind of looking at that intersection with benefits continuation. And then any retaliation is prohibited with somebody taking PFML. You know, the question comes up, okay, well, if somebody doesn't have job restoration rights, then what does it mean if I can't hold their job open while they're on a PFML absence? Could somebody then claim that that's retaliation for taking PFML? Possibly, but you don't have any obligation to job protect. But being mindful of that there's prohibition on retaliation for using PFML. And where I would see this come up more is I don't see you then having some obligation to job restore if you don't meet this requirement. But with the retaliation piece, if they were to give you the 30 days notice that they're intending to take leave, retaliation would come up if you said, oh, you're taking leave in 30 days, then just leave now. That is going to kind of trigger that retaliation piece. So that's where I think an employee would have a claim potentially for retaliation. Okay, how are the premiums paid? So employers collect the deductions from the employee paychecks. The total amount is 0.4% gross, and that's a division between the employee deduction, which is going to be about two-thirds of that, so about, I think it's 0.263 gross, and then employers with 50 or more employees in Washington also pay toward the medical leave premium. So the family leave premium, that's covered completely by employee deductions. The remainder, about a third of the total premium, will be covered by the larger employers. And then employers submit to the state on a quarterly basis. Again, the reporting was delayed in 2019, but my understanding is it's now on track. And then some of you may have approved voluntary plans or may still be considering it. It's never too late to look at a voluntary plan. You can still submit it at any point in time. You won't get your deductions back that you've paid into the state program, but you would then you'd remove the leave from the state and you'd administer it yourself. So, you know, I recommend that clients that have robust short-term disability plans or already provide pretty extensive benefits for paid parental leave or other paid purposes, to keep voluntary plans in the back of your mind in case that looks like a more attractive option. Okay, again, the 0.4% is on the employee's gross pay. It's a deduction. One-third goes to family. Two-thirds goes to medical. ESD has said that they may reallocate that based on seeing how people use the leave. So the understanding is that more people use leave for their own serious health conditions is why there's a bigger allocation to the medical leave portion. But again, that may be reallocated based on how people use it. Okay, and then turning it over to Angela for some intersection with other laws.
Great, thanks, Kate. So I'm going to be talking about how PFML benefits intersect with other laws, including FMLA, as Kate has been talking about. So with the FMLA, the federal law, only employees who work 1,250 hours in the last 12 months for their current employers who have 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius are covered. And so starting in 2020 with PFML, there's going to be a lot more employees who are going to be eligible for benefits because the eligibility bar is much lower. Now it's employees who worked for 820 hours in the past four quarters for any Washington employer. It's a portable benefit from employer to employer. So that means on, you know, day one when you hire somebody, that employee may be eligible for PFML leave. They may not be eligible for FMLA leave, but they may have that eligibility for the state leave. The covered purposes of FMLA and PFML leaves are pretty similar. They both cover medical leave for an employee's own serious health condition. They both also cover family leave to bond with a new baby, for birthplace and adoption of a child, or to care for a family member who has a serious health condition. But under PFML, there's an expanded definition of family member, which we're going to be talking about. So not only are employees going to be eligible to use the state leave earlier or more often than under the FMLA, there's also going to be a broader array of uses for the eligibility uses for the leave. So, under the FMLA, a family member is defined as a child, a parent, a spouse, or a state registered domestic partner. With the PFML, family members expand to grandparents, grandchildren, siblings, and in-laws, and that includes parents-in-law, siblings-in-law. So I'm going to be able to take time off under the state leave to care for my sibling, to care for my grandparents, whereas under the FMLA, I won't have that same ability. And so there's going to be instances where the use of leave, maybe both FMLA use and PFML use, like for birth or bonding with a new child, but there's going to be some other uses that are only exclusive to PFML. The duration of the leave is also different under the laws. So under the FMLA, the duration of the leave is 12 weeks in a 12-month time period. Under PFML, it's between 12 and 18 weeks where an employee can be out receiving partial wage replacement. It's 12 weeks if you have a family or medical condition, 16 weeks if the employee has both a family or medical leave condition, and then up to 18 weeks in a year if an employee is pregnant and has a serious health condition that incapacitates them, such as bed rest or some other related condition. So now we have an expanded time period where the employee can be out under the state leave law. Now, I should note as well, under the Washington law against discrimination, employees can take leave or other accommodations for medical issues for disabilities, including pregnancy-related leave. And under the Washington Law Against Discrimination, there is no limitation on how much pregnancy disability leave an employee can take. Now, we haven't gotten a lot of guidance from the state on how the Washington Disability Law is going to intersect with the PFML, but that law is not going to sunset, so we still have that in existence. And hopefully we get more guidance, more information on this and how the laws will intersect here soon. The funding and the pay of FMLA and the state leave law are also different. Under FMLA, the time off is unpaid, though many employers offer or require employees to use available paid time off, sick time, vacation time, et cetera, while they're on FMLA leave. Some employers also have short-term disability policies that provide for pay or compensation while the employee is out on leave. With PFML, it's going to be a paid leave benefit. And again, as Kate mentioned, that's funded through premiums that are paid by both employees and employers. The benefit amount is going to vary, and it's going to depend on the employee's actual wages. And I understand that the ESD is working on updating a insurance benefit calculator that should be up back online in 2020 to help employers and employees calculate how much individual employees' benefits amounts will be. There's a max to that benefit. It's $1,000 weekly. So employees will receive, under PFML, up to $1,000 weekly, and it's meant to be a partial wage replacement. An interesting thing to note is intermittent leave. Under the FMLA, intermittent leave is permitted for medical issues, and the increments can vary. It can be an hour, it can be a day. It just depends on what the purpose of the leave is for, and it's permitted under the FMLA, but it's not permitted, intermittent leave is not permitted for baby bonding. Now note, under the PFML, the minimum increment of intermittent leave is 8 hours. So that's an 8-hour time period. And there's nothing in the law that prohibits an employee from taking intermittent baby bonding leave, which is, I think, going to be a very interesting challenge for employers because that's much different than the landscape we know right now with FMLA. We're hoping to get some more guidance on this. About how this is going to work. And we understand the increment, the 8-hour increment, may change as well. But I think that the intermittent leave time increment, as well as the fact that it is permitted for baby bonding under the state leave law, I think that's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out in the next year. So in addition to FMLA, we also have a number of laws in Washington, locally, as well as federally, that provide leave for employees. In Washington, we have the Washington Family Leave Act, which is the state law equivalent of the FMLA. And with the PFML going into effect, the ability for employees to be able to use leave in 2020, that law is going to sunset. So Washington's Family Leave Act is going to sunset. PFML is basically going to take the place of that law and now provide for the paid family leave. We also have the Washington Family Care Act that allows employees to use available vacation, sick time, et cetera, to care for family members. That law is going to remain in effect, as will the Domestic Violence Leave Law. I already mentioned the Washington Law Against Discrimination, which allows for accommodations and leave for disabilities, including pregnancy-related accommodations. We have workers' comp. We also have state and local protected sick leave laws that have their own requirements and also restrictions on, use and employers' ability to kind of monitor that use. And then we have federal laws as well, the FMLA, the ADA, and then USERRA, which relates to military-related leave. So a lot of different laws here. The PFML law is one of the first that provides for a paid leave benefit. And so we'll see a lot of changes over the next year. So on one of the big changes this year was an amendment to the PFML law that allows for supplemental benefits. And so let's talk about what those are. So a supplemental benefit under the new law is, under the amended law, is excluded from the definition of wages. So the law was amended to update what the definition of wages were, and wages are basically, compensation paid to employees. And within that definition of wages, there's a specific exclusion for supplemental benefits. And these supplemental benefits basically allow employers to offer available PTO, sick time, vacation time, parental leave, et cetera, to employees to top off the amounts that they're going to receive from the state. And so a supplemental benefit is essentially an employer's existing PTO, vacation time, parental leave, et cetera, that the employee can use while they're on PFML leave. And so there's phase six rules that are being finalized right now, and they include a definition of supplemental benefits, which is a payment offered by an employer to an employee who's taking leave. And I think there's some confusion around this because a supplemental benefit is essentially your existing PTO, vacation, or sick time, but because the employee is receiving that amount while they're out on leave, that's what makes it a supplemental benefit. Employers can offer these benefits, these supplemental benefits, to employees. There's no requirement that they do so. And so the ESC has said, basically, employers, do what you want. You can offer these benefits. You don't have to. I think a really significant point here is that it's going to be the employee's choice as to whether or not they want to use that available PTO or sick time to top off what they receive from the state, because that's different than the federal law, the FMLA. So let's talk about that. So under the FMLA, employers can require that employees use available time off while they're on FMLA leave. So, if I have, 12 weeks of vacation, wouldn't that be nice? I don't really have 12 weeks of vacation, but if I have available vacation time, I would apply that to my FMLA leave and receive paid time off while I'm on FMLA leave. And under the law, employers can require that. This is not permitted under the PFML. So under the PFML, employers can offer the benefits, but the employees have the right to choose whether or not they want to take them. And there will be instances, as we've mentioned, where there's both, where there's an event, care for my time off for my own medical condition, where I'm going to qualify for both FMLA leave and state leave. And the ESD has taken the position, as far as we understand it, that even during times where the employee's eligible for both FMLA leave and for state leave, that employers can't require that the employees use those supplemental benefits. Now, that's different than the federal law, which says that you can. So we will see how that plays out. It will be interesting. And then something else to note about supplemental benefits and reporting is, because supplemental benefits are not wages, they should not be reported to the ESD as wages, because if they're reported by the employee on their weekly reports or by the employer, that will reduce the employee's weekly benefit amount. So they're excluded. They shouldn't be reported. We understand from the ESD, if they're accidentally reported by the employee, that, the employer and the employee can work through that and with the ESD and, rectify the situation. We anticipate some of that will happen, because I think the employee may be confused. If they're getting PTO, while they're out on PFML, they may report that as PTO. And so just be aware of that. Some other things to take note of is that employees may be able to receive amounts in excess of their normal wages. So if you offered employees, 8 hours of PTO, plus they're getting their partial wage replacement, they could potentially earn more while they're out on leave than had they been working. That's not something we recommend doing, but it is something that could happen. And because the supplemental benefits are not being reported to the ESD, the ESD won't be tracking that. And the rules also, because they're not reportable wages, don't include a ceiling on the amount of supplemental benefits that can be provided to employees. So I think we're going to have some administrative challenges from the employer standpoint and the employee standpoint related to how to categorize, how to code from a payroll standpoint, you know, the PTO or vacation that supplemental benefits versus, you know, regular vacation or PTO time. So just be aware of that as you work through these issues. And now I think I will hand it off to Christine to talk about health benefits.
Thanks, Angela. So right to continuation of health benefits. This has been, I think, we've received a lot of questions on this topic, and I know ESD has also received a lot of commentary. So benefits continuation, what is required? The RCW states that if required by the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, as it existed on October 19th, 2017, and then to paraphrase, employers are required to continue medical benefits while the employee is on a PFML leave. We don't know what this necessarily means, and I think a lot of the questions we've received are small employers with fewer than 50 employees required to continue benefits? What if the leave is taken to care for a non-FMLA purpose, such as taking care of a sibling? What if FMLA has already been exhausted? And the plain reading of the statute as it reads right now is that unless the employee is on an FMLA leave, they would not be eligible to receive benefits continuation. We are not sure that ESD agrees with that position, and based on calls with them this week, actually, it does appear that we will receive further guidance on this next week in final rulemaking. These are all fabulous questions, and I know we've also received questions about what if an employee is on PFML and returns to work. If you're continuing their benefits, do you have the same right to recoup your portion of the premium payments if they do not return as you do under the FMLA? And again, that's just not, you know, an answer that we have at this point. Similarly, if an employee fails to share their cost of the premiums, can you terminate their coverage as you can under the FMLA? And for right now, I would say yes, because the rule is really under the FMLA, and it doesn't appear that ESD has created a separate protection for continued benefits for PFML purposes only. But again, I want to note that this is subject to change and likely will change with the final rules that come out next week. One thing to keep in mind, you know, depending on how the final rules come down, you still want to follow the terms of your plan document. And for many of you, that will mean that your plan, you know, essentially has a active hours requirement or a minimum hours requirement. And when somebody goes out on a leave and falls below that hours requirement, they will generally lose their health coverage unless there is a carved out exception. And your plans right now will have an exception for FMLA protected leave, but there is no exception in your plans for a PFML protected leave. And so if it is the case that PFML does require something more generous than FMLA, we will want to, you know, we encourage you to certainly look at your benefit plans before offering continued coverage to someone on PFML leave to make sure that that is permitted by your plan and has been approved by your insurance carrier or your stop loss carrier. Another question we've gotten, and we will address the continuation question a bit more in detail in our Q&A section, as well as kind of the intersection of PFML and short-term disability leave. I know that's also been a popular question. The other question we've received are PFML benefits taxable? I'll let Jason Barrett, our guest speaker, address that as well, but our understanding is that Washington State has reached out to the IRS for guidance on whether the PFML benefits are taxable or should be tax-free. This would include your premium deductions that you're making, the employer contributions towards the premium portion, and then also the benefits themselves. The IRS has elected not to provide guidance regarding the tax treatment at this time. It's our understanding that, you know, Washington State has been placed on a priority list, but because so many states have been adopting similar programs this year and in next year. The IRS has delayed any additional guidance. Until guidance is received, it's our understanding, and we'll let Jason clarify during the Q&A section, but that employers should treat the premium deductions as taxable and would report those on an employee's Form W-2 as other income. For the voluntary plans, the benefits will essentially be treated like you treat other benefit payments. So if the employee paid the premium on the employee paid only, then benefits would be tax-free. And if the premiums were paid by both the employer and the employee or by employer only, then the benefits would be taxable. If the benefits, if you're using the state program and the benefits are paid by the state, then it is our understanding that ESD will likely issue a Form 1099-G to the employee and report the benefits on the Form 1099-G. But ESD has indicated to us that they will make that determination by June 2020. So I think we'll move on now. I know we've received a number of questions during the presentation, and I have tried to track them. And for the most part, I think most of the questions will be addressed. I do apologize if we miss your question. You can always follow up with us. Kate does want to jump in on one question that came in, so I'll let her go ahead on that.
And this is one that a few people weighed in on clarification on what the year is. And I did want to provide that clarity as far as how you count the claim year. And so that's covered under WAC 192-500-070. And the claim year is defined as a 52-week period beginning Sunday of the week of A, the date of placement, birth or placement of a child, or B, the date of the filing of a complete and timely application for all other qualifying events. And then two, for applications that are backdated, the claim year is the 52-week period beginning Sunday of the week to which the application was backdated. And three, an employee may only have one open claim year at a time. So I just wanted to clarify that because I saw that question come up a few different times, and then I'll turn it back to Christine. I think we actually may even get to hear from our guest.
Yes. So we do have our guest speaker here with us today. Welcome to Jason Barrett from the Employment Security Department. Jason, if you don't mind kicking us off with some general questions, the first one being, how do employees file for paid family leave?
Sure. So first, let me start by just saying how much I appreciate Davis Hertz Remain inviting me on this webinar. We're always extremely eager to reach out to as many folks as possible and help address some of these more complicated questions, because at ESD, we do recognize that this is a very, very complex program. A lot of new requirements that employers are going to have to follow, and we definitely are sympathetic to that. So we really want to make this process as easy as possible for everybody. And webinars like this are one of our best tools to do that. So thank you all for attending, and thank you again to Davis Wright Tremaine. So to the specific question of how employees will file for paid family leave, that will occur through our website, which is paidleave.wa.gov. Employees will be required to create an online account through Secure Access Washington, SAW for short, and they will essentially fill out an online profile and application in order to submit their initial request for benefits. That initial application is going to require information like the type of leave being requested, the dates for which leave is being requested, just sort of essential information of that nature to help us determine whether or not the employee is in fact eligible for benefits. Assuming the leave is granted and once leave begins, that employee will also use that same portal to file their weekly application, which has been referenced a few times already throughout this wonderful presentation. And essentially, once the leave begins, the employee will use that same portal to submit any information to us that we need to know about the leave once it actually begins. Information like any hours that they're working and any hours of paid time off that they've taken that their employers have not designated as supplemental. And the reason we do that is because we are going to reduce the employee's benefit amounts proportionally by any hours worked and any hours of paid time off taken that were not supplemental. So that's going to be the primary portal through which employees will apply for and interact with this program. There are a few other alternatives available. There is a paper application available as well that can be requested through our helpline. Last information I heard that paper application will also be available at all of our ESD WorkSource sites around the state. WorkSource offices are located really kind of everywhere throughout the state, so paper applications will be available for those individuals who prefer to work with paper instead of computers. But those will be the two primary methods through which employees will interact with this program.
Thanks, Jason. So if the employer, one question that came in during our presentation is whether the employer has any obligation to inform employees how to follow the application process.
So there are two notification requirements that employers are required to adhere to. They deal less with process and more with just general information about the program. There is a public notice requirement that needs to be posted in kind of a general public area, like a break room or a lunchroom, for example, very similar to what LNI requires. There's also a second requirement, once an employee begins leave, that the employer is aware would be eligible for paid family and medical leave. There is a requirement that the employer send a notification to the employee informing them of their potential eligibility for this program. But as far as the best information for exactly how an employee applies for this program, that information is best provided at paidleave.wa.gov, where a real step-by-step process is available through our employee toolkit.
Great, thank you. So one question was, how will the state be communicating with employers? Will employers have access to view the claim dates and approval statuses of their employees and the amount of benefits they're receiving?
Yeah, I think this was touched on a little bit during the presentation, but I'm happy to reiterate the fact that employers have been named an interested party on the initial determination for benefits. What that means is that for every determination made as it relates to the initial application for benefits, so we're talking about whether or not the employee is approved, the benefit amount, the duration of leave, all of that kind of essential information that is provided in the initial application, any determinations that the department makes based on that application that we send to the employee will also be sent to the employer as a result of the employer being named an interested party. So the employer will have the essential facts of the leave that the employee is taking, specifically duration and benefit amount. I know benefit amount is of particular interest to employers who are seeking to provide supplemental benefits. So the employer will have all the information that the employee has as it relates to that initial determination of eligibility for the program.
Super. Thank you, Jason. So, Kate, I have a question for you. Can an employee with family or medical in 2019 be eligible for benefits in 2020? Including birth, placement, or adoption of a child?
And this is a good one. I touched on it in the beginning of the presentation, but it's a good one to go back to, particularly with the rollout starting in a few weeks. Yes, but again,
it depends
on if they have 820 hours. And so that what the state's going to do is look at it really independent of anything that happened in 2019. As of January 1, 2020, does the individual have a qualifying event? Is the birth or placement of a child within 12 months counting back, looking at that claim year? And I'm going to switch it a little bit because there was a question that came in during the presentation about what if the employee is currently on leave right now? So say you have an employee that's out on FMLA leave right now, and that FMLA leave is going to extend into 2020. What happens with that employee? Their PFML date is going to start January 1, 2020, assuming they apply on that date. And then for this example, they'd be baby bonding, so they wouldn't have a waiting period. But their leave would start January 1, 2020, and so they would get the full extent of their PFML leave, even if they're on a protected FMLA leave right now. They do still need to apply to the state, even if they're already on a protected leave, because this is a completely separate program than our federal FMLA, and there's a very detailed application process through the state.
Thanks, Kate. So if an employee has used or exhausted their FMLA in 2019, will they be entitled to an additional period of time under the PFML in 2020?
Yes, and I think Jason agrees with me on this. And it goes to the last example as well. Even if they don't have any FMLA leave available, what the state's going to look at is, do they meet the eligibility requirements under the state program? And we're going to look at the 820 hours within the last 4 or 5 calendar quarters.
Another question that came in for you, Kate, is, are in-laws covered by PFML?
Yes, and if you look at the definition of family members, it does expand out to in-laws. And so while the law itself covers, the kind of expansion from FMLA to include siblings, grandparents, grandchildren, that will extend as well to in-laws.
We also received another number of questions about job protection. Angela, are you able to receive job protection of PFML without taking the paid partial wage replacement benefit?
Thanks, Christine. Employees have to actually apply for and be approved for PFML leave in order to potentially be eligible for those job protections. So no, you can't just opt to take the partial wage replacement.
And do job protections, is it correct that there are no job protections associated directly with PFMLA leave unless it runs concurrently with FML?
Well, that's a good question, and I think Kate covered this in part during her presentation. So employees who are on an approved PFML leave also could have job restoration rights. It depends on whether or not the employees worked for at least 1,250 hours in the last year with an employer who has 50 or more employees in Washington. One question that we're still waiting for some further guidance on from the ESD, and I think will be addressed in some upcoming rulemaking, is whether or not, if the employee's out on PFML leave for a reason that's not protected by FMLA, so to care for a sibling, et cetera, would those job restoration rights apply in those situations if the employee also meets that 1,250 hours in the past year for an employer with 50 or more employees? So more to come on that.
Okay. I think I can actually speak
to that right now. There is an independent employment restoration provision in the PFML statute. Job protection under PFML is not dependent on FMLA in any way, shape, or form. There is an independent job protection provision that protects an employee's employment rights, assuming that they meet the 1,250-hour requirement. The requirements are very similar to FMLA, almost identical. There are a handful of small differences. For example, the 75-mile radius requirement that exists in FMLA is not in PFML. For FMLA, it's 50 employees total anywhere in the world. In PFML, it's 50 employees in the state. So, for example, let's say if Walmart only had 25 employees in Washington, those 25 employees would not be eligible for job protection, even though obviously Walmart nationwide has several more than 50 employees. So again, FMLA is not the vehicle for job protection under this law. There is job protection independent under paid family medical leave.
Jason, is it accurate that that there is going to be some more guidance or rulemaking on this?
Rulemaking will be ongoing for this program for, I would probably guess, decades. So I would say the answer is probably yes.
Thanks for clarifying.
On the topic of job protection, it protects my job that there will be lots of rulemaking on this program. So. You can almost certainly expect additional rulemaking around this and all topics at some point in the future. But as far as the question being asked goes, which I believe was, is FMLA the vehicle for job protection? The answer is no. The requirements are similar, but as long as the employee qualifies for job protection under our law, they are entitled to that right.
And this is Kate. I wanted to jump in really quick on a question that just came in that is relevant to this. The question is, if there's no job protection for employers with less than 50 employees, then does this mean the employer of this size could deny a leave request? And Jason, if you disagree with me, feel free. I'm okay with you disagreeing with me. But no, you cannot deny the leave request. The person is eligible to take PFML. You cannot restrict their ability to go to the state to apply for the leave to take PFML. But they don't have a job restoration right under the law. And so in this situation, because you're a small employer, you could deny job restoration. You could replace the person while they're out on leave. One additional thing to keep in mind is for employers who are under 150 employees, there is some availability to go to the state and request funds to rehire for that position so that you could kind of provide job protection even though you're not technically covered. And Jason, I don't know if you have anything to add to that one.
Yeah, I think that's mostly accurate. For a small business, as far as whether or not you can deny the leave, I suppose the answer to that question is no, in that you cannot show up at someone's house and drag them to their desk and force them to sit there. If the employee is going to stay home, they're going to stay home. The question as to whether or not they are eligible for the benefit is a separate question, which they would only have to meet the 820-hour requirement. There is no employee count requirement for whether or not they get the paycheck from the state. And then whether or not when the employee walks back in the door after their leave ends, whether or not they are entitled to the same or a similar job that they had when they left, that is when job protection comes in. And that right to have that same or similar position would only apply to an employee who works for an employer with at least 50 employees and a few other requirements as well.
Thanks, Jason. Changing gears just a bit, Angela, can an employer give an employee an attendance occurrence while on PFMLA if they supplement with the extended illness bank or PTO?
So the PFML law prohibits interference with or retaliation against employees who exercise their rights under the law. And so employers can't discipline employees or give them an attendance occurrence for requesting or using PFML leave. There may be situations where an employee's on an intermittent PFML leave and they have some attendance issue unrelated to that PFML usage. I mean, you definitely could address that attendance issue, but you cannot discipline employees or have an attendance occurrence for use of that leave.
All right, thanks. Jason, back to you on this one. If we have a CBA that was in effect prior to October 2017 and it has not had a reopener, at what point must the employer notify ESD and begin deducting the premium?
Sure. So just a little bit of context on this question. I think it was touched on a little bit during the presentation, but just to reiterate, if an employer has a CBA that is in effect today and has been in effect since at least October of 2017 or prior to that, as long as that CBA is still in effect today and has not been reopened or renegotiated, then the employer and the employees who are in that bargaining unit in no way, shape, or form are required to participate in paid family and medical leave. That means no premiums, no reporting, and the employees are not entitled to the leave or the benefit. However, once that CBA is reopened or renegotiated or expires, everything kicks in immediately. So essentially what that means is that on the day, so let's say that a CBA expires at midnight on June 30th. Starting the next day, the employer is going to be required to adhere to all requirements, premium payments, reporting requirements, everything for all wages and hours from that point forward. They are also required to notify the department that their CBA has expired so that we know that, okay, you were out up until this point, but now you're in. And that notification can be sent to our care team, and I can get some information about phone numbers and contact information for our care team as well. But essentially, the answer is immediately. All hours worked and wages paid from the point the CBA expires forward will be liable for the premium and must be reported to the department. Now, if an employee who was covered by that CBA applies for the benefit that next day, you know, if they're a full-time employee, obviously they've worked more than 820 in the qualifying period, but we will not have the wages and hours on record for that employee because the employer was not required to report up to this point. In that event, we will work with the employer to capture that data, the hours and wages that we would need to calculate their benefit duration and amount, and the employee would still be eligible for PFML beginning on day one after the expiration of that CBA, assuming that they would otherwise be eligible.
So this is Angelo. We just got a question in about whether or not an employee can resign or leave a position who's out on approved PFML leave and continue to receive PFML pay. And the answer is possibly yes. If the employee is eligible for PFML, if they meet that 820-hour requirement and they're out for a qualifying reason, that benefit is portable from employer to employer and doesn't depend on their continued employment with you. So that's a big change from FMLA leave.
Thanks, Angela. We also had a couple of questions addressing voluntary plans. Kate, what happens when a pregnant employee who has switched jobs does not meet the new employer's voluntary plan requirements?
And this one is a little bit of a unique situation because there was an amendment to the law this year with voluntary plans. As it was previously drafted, if you had an employee who started with you and you have an approved voluntary plan and that employee came from an employer with a voluntary plan, they would automatically go on your voluntary plan. But as the way the law was previously drafted, there was a 320-hour period before they could go onto your voluntary plan that they had to wait. The amendment to the law removed that. You can opt to put an employee on your voluntary plan right away if you choose to do so. But let's say in this scenario, the pregnant employee comes on, you have that 320-hour period before they can go on your voluntary plan, and she gives birth between 0 and 320 hours. That employee would still be eligible for PFML, but she would be under the state program, assuming that she worked the eligibility, the 820 hours for any Washington employer in the qualifying period. And so it wouldn't be that this employee couldn't get PFML. It would just be through the state.
Thanks, Kate. Jason, this one's for you. For employers that have submitted and received approval for voluntary plans in 2019, when will the annual voluntary plan submissions be due to ESD?
So the department is doing rolling reviews of voluntary plans. We are required to assess an employee's voluntary plan each year to make sure that it is still in compliance with the law and the rules each year for the first 3 years of the plan's existence. There's no set calendar right now. It's essentially random, but essentially once per year, an employee will be required to kind of just update us on what their plan looks like and make sure that they're in compliance. I can't tell you exactly when in that year the review will occur, but essentially from the day you are approved, at some point over the next year, the department will reach out and just make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And then you won't hear from us again for the remainder of that year. And then every year thereafter, for two more years, at some point in that year, you'll hear from us. And then after that 3-year mark, you'll only hear from us, and there only needs to be that communication if there are any changes to your plan that the employer is making that is not the result of a statutory change. So every year for the first 3 years, and then only then if you make a change that is not required by a law change.
Great. Thanks, Jason. So we're going to move next to supplemental benefits questions. Angela, I think this was touched on in your presentation, but it's a great question to revisit. Will employees be able to supplement PFML with sick and vacation pay?
Christine, the answer is yes. So under the law, employers can offer available vacation time, sick time, PTO to employees to top off their state benefits. And again, the employees have the option as to whether or not to actually use these supplemental benefits. There's no requirement that employers offer them, but they are an option. And I just want to clarify one thing as well. I saw some questions about whether or not employers have to report vacation, PTO, et cetera, as wages. The answer is yes, if that time off is not a supplemental benefit, if it's not being provided to an employee while they're out on PFML leave. So if an employee's out on leave and they're getting a top off with vacation or sick time, that's not reportable. If they're not out on leave and they're getting vacation or sick time, that is reportable. And Jason, please correct me if I misspoke there.
No, you got it 100% right. I think it helps a lot of times to kind of speak in examples. We're talking about supplemental benefits, so I'll give that a shot. So normally, let's set aside top off and things like that. Whenever an employee is out on leave, they are required to submit the weekly application, and they're required to report PTO taken and hours worked. If an employee wanted to try to top off their benefit without supplemental benefits, they wouldn't be able to. Because basically they would take the PTO, report it to us, we'd reduce the benefits, which would require more PTO, which would reduce the benefit more, and it would just get into an endless loop where the employee would never reach 100%. With the addition of supplemental benefits, the employer and the employee are permitted to reach an agreement, essentially, where the employee can use X number of hours of PTO in order to top off their benefit up to 100% of their normal pay. When that happens, and there needs to really be that communication between the employer and the employee about whether or not PTO can be used in this manner, assuming that that is available to the employee and they elected to go ahead and use it, then they will not report that PTO to us, because if they do, then we're going to reduce their benefit and we're going to get caught in that loop again. So it's really important that the employer really make it clear to the employee that, okay, this is supplemental and you can use this to top off, but don't report it to the department when you file your weekly application. Go ahead.
So just to confirm, will ESD be providing the employers with the exact weekly dollar amount of the PFML benefits that the state is paying?
To the employer or to the employee?
To the employer.
To the employer. No, the employer will only see the base weekly benefit amount. Theoretically, the employer would know if, what hours were worked and what PTO was taken from the employee to be able to basically figure out on their own exactly how much was paid to the employee. But And this is, I think, ties in a bit to kind of other internal benefit programs that employers can offer. For example, short-term disability. There are lots of employers around the state that offer short-term disability payments to employees who are out on leave for a lot of the same reasons that are covered by PFML. An employer, absolutely nothing would stop them from saying to the employee, okay, you can be eligible for this extra top-off that we're going to pay you, just cash money, not PTO, just straight up cash. You can get that money from us, but as a requirement to be eligible for that payment from us, the employer, you have to show us what you're getting from the state. You have to show us the exact dollar amount. There's nothing that would prevent an employer from requiring that. We just want to make sure that as the employer is not requiring the employee to do anything with PFML as a condition of employment. As a condition of a benefit, though, the employer has a lot of flexibility in terms of what they want to see from the employee in order to be eligible for that payment.
And this is Kate. To clarify one point, Jason, so when the employee gets notice of the weekly benefit amount, let's say that employee only works for one employer. They are going to say they max out at $1,000 per week. The employer is going to get that information as far as what the weekly benefit amount is so that they can then determine the top off. I think where there could be some confusion is if an employee works for more than one employer at a given time, the weekly benefit amount is going to be a combination of those multiple jobs, and the employer won't know from that specific thing that ESC gives them what portion of that is coming from them. Is that correct?
That is correct, which again, if the employer is looking to top off, then they can absolutely require the employee to provide them with the payment that they're getting from the state. Because to your point, it is right. The employer will see the base amount that the employee is entitled to, but if they're continuing to work at another job, for example, a job that might be less labor intensive than the job that they are taking leave from, then those hours would reduce their benefit payment because the benefit amount takes all wages into account, not just wages earned from the employer from which leave is being taken. So yes, that's a good point, which is why we really wanted to give employers a lot of flexibility in terms of what they can require from their employee who are looking to top off their employee's benefit payment from the state.
Thanks, Jason. Kate, can we require employees to use their PTO accruals during their waiting period and top up against their state benefit?
So, and I would answer this in two parts. So when you think about the waiting period is going to be that first week of the approved PFML leave. And so say an individual is approved for 12 weeks. And their first day out is Monday, just to make it easy. So their waiting week is that first week. They are not going to receive PFML benefits during that week. There will be no retro payment for the waiting period. So the position that I have taken, and I'm sure Jason will correct me if he disagrees, is that yes, an employer can require employees to use their existing leave buckets on the waiting period week, because that employee is not getting supplemental benefits at that point in time. You designate that as PTO. You say you're required to use PTO during your waiting period to whittle down that leave bucket. However, it's a different answer for the topping off, because in order to have them access their PTO bucket while they're receiving PFML and not have the PFML award reduced, it needs to be designated as supplemental benefits. And an employee gets to choose whether or not they use supplemental benefits.
Thanks, Kate. Is there a way to structure supplemental pay leave benefits to incentivize an employee to take leave concurrently?
And yes, I think, and Jason touched on this a little as far as, you know, you can still control your own leave policies. And so you can make them available conditioned on the employee going to get PFML. So an easier example is a paid parental leave policy. So let's say you have a paid parental leave policy and you offer, or you want to offer, 4 weeks of full pay to employees. You can say, employee, in order to access this paid parental leave bucket, you must provide us with notice that you are getting PFML, and we will provide the top off for 4 weeks so that we get you to full pay. So you can condition access to your leave buckets, your supplemental benefits, for them going to the state and getting PFML. So I think there are ways to incentivize. I think, too, on the front end, you know, for people that are only receiving a more of like the, if they top off at $1,000 per week, but they're a high wage earner and that's not a huge percentage of their pay, there's probably more incentive for that person to want to top off with supplemental benefits so that they are getting full pay. And also people generally need their full pay in order to, you know, live their life as they want to. And so I think there's kind of that natural incentive of people wanting to be on full pay, where you can provide an explanation before people go on leave saying, we offer you this great benefit. You can use your existing leave buckets as supplemental benefits so that you don't have any wage reduction while you're off on PFML, that this is only a partial wage reimbursement, but we will allow you to use your existing leave buckets as supplemental benefits. So I think there's a communication aspect and also kind of a more creative workaround to condition your benefits on PFML.
Great, thanks, Kate. So we'll move on next to our benefits questions. The first question being, if an employee has exhausted FMLA or does not qualify for FMLA, yet qualifies and goes on a PFMLA leave, is the employer required to continue the employee's medical benefits? And again, this is a question where we don't have a clear answer. Again, the way the RCW is currently written, the plain language indicates the answer is no, that only if an employee is on FMLA and qualifies for FMLA does the employer need to continue the employee's medical benefits. But again, we believe that is subject to change and may be clarified in next week's final rulemaking. We also had a question about if someone's just on unpaid leave status, should they be terminated from coverage and given a COBRA notice? That is, you know, typically what your plan document says. If somebody is on a non-FMLA leave and experiences a termination or loses their coverage due to a reduction in their hours, then at that time, you know, depending on how your plan is written, as of the last day of the month in which they've gone on that leave, or if you have a built-in grace period following that grace period, then you would terminate their coverage and offer COBRA at that time. But again, if ESD does come out with rules for PFML that are more generous than what is required for FML, then it will be time to essentially revisit our plan documents, negotiate with the insurance carriers, and even amend the health plans if that is required. And that's certainly something that we can, you know, follow up on once the final rules are issued next week. Another question we received, a few questions we've received have related to short-term disability. And essentially, if we offer a short-term disability plan, how will short-term disability integrate with the state plan and PFML benefits? You know, my understanding is that for most short-term disability plans, you will have a built-in offset in your plan document that says if somebody receives, you know, additional wages or other benefits, then your short-term disability benefit will be reduced by that amount. For most, you know, STD benefits, the wage replacement is 60% of regular wages. So if PFML is covering 60% of wages, the short-term disability benefit would be reduced to zero. But if PFML is covering less than 60%, or if you have a short-term disability plan that does not include such an offset, then you would pay the short-term disability on top of the PFML leave, which I think leads to another question which we've received, which, Jason, I'm hoping you can answer, which is whether payment of short-term disability is treated in the same manner as a supplemental benefit so as not to impact the PFML benefit calculation, or whether that would impact the calculation.
It would not impact the calculation. Short-term disability payments have never been considered a wage under the Paid Family Medical Leave Program. So it has no impact on an employee's benefits calculation on their payment while they're on leave. Short-term disability payments can be made with zero impact on the employee's PFML eligibility or payment.
Great. Thank you, Jason. One other question for you, and I did touch on this briefly in our presentation about the tax treatment of the PFML benefits, but I've seen some follow-up questions with employers who are confused about whether they should be withholding the deductions on a pre-tax basis or imputing income for employer contributions. Can you provide any additional clarification on that, or is that something we're going to have to wait on?
I think it was covered pretty well earlier. As far as the taxability of the premium and the benefit, We did submit a private letter ruling request to the IRS, which they declined to provide. So they they have elected instead to offer kind of general guidance that all states who may or may not have a PFML program in place can follow. As far as the pre-tax, you know, the premium, the 0.4% is assessed on gross wages. So it's that top, that first number that is on an employee's pay stub. So it is on the entirety of the employee's gross wages that the premium is assessed on. But as far as the federal income tax liability of the premium payment and the benefit payment, as I said, the IRS has declined to provide us directly with guidance, and hopefully we'll get that from them sometime next year.
I wanted to jump in on a couple questions that were clarifying things I spoke to recently. One person asked, you cannot condition paid sick leave on use of paid family medical leave, correct? And yes, that is correct. To the extent that it's protected paid sick and safe time either under the City of Seattle ordinance or under state law. So if you have your own separate sick leave bucket that's not protected, you get to do whatever you want with that. But you are correct in that L&I has taken the position you cannot force somebody to ever use their protected paid sick leave. Second real quick question to clarify, does the PFML waiting period count toward the maximum leave duration under PFML? Yes, it is a 1 week unpaid, or portion of a week unpaid, that's going to count to the total 12, 16, 18 week allotment. So I just wanted to jump in on those since they needed a clarification. Angela also wants to jump in, too.
I just want to jump in quickly as well, just to clarify that the Washington Family Leave Act is sunsetting and being replaced by PFML. And so the PFML is essentially now the state law equivalent of the FMLA plus. So that is happening. I also wanted to clarify the Washington Law Against Discrimination and the related pregnancy accommodations is still in effect. And so we're getting a lot of questions about the interplay of that. Essentially, the pregnancy accommodation law in Washington doesn't have a time period on how long leave for a pregnancy-related condition could continue on. And so that law still remains in effect. And now we also have the PFML that provides for both medical leave for the employee's own health condition, including related to pregnancy, and for baby bonding. And now that's up to 18 weeks of paid family medical leave for that reason. Plus, if the employee has a pregnancy-related condition that goes beyond that, they'd still be eligible for unpaid state pregnancy-related accommodation.
And I think, too, along with that, Angela, the Washington Family Care Act is going nowhere. You still have it. So I know there's been some confusion what's sunsetting, what's not. All that's sunsetting is the Washington Family Leave Act.
Kate, we've gotten a lot of questions about how PFML and FMLA work together. Will they run concurrently, or how do they interplay?
That's a great question, Christine, and one that comes up a lot. And I've seen that it's come up a lot today as well. So let's start off with, you cannot, as an employer, you cannot require that an employee go get PFML. So if you have an employee that comes to you and says, I would like to take my federal FMLA leave, please, you say, wonderful, here's your certification, and see if they're approved. So you could have a scenario where a person goes, gets their unpaid FMLA leave. You could require them to use all their existing paid leave buckets because, as Angela covered, you're allowed to do that under federal law. But they could potentially stack them. They could take their FMLA, and then they could go to the state and take their PFML. And then you would want to look under the job protection under FMLA as it relates to the FMLA leave, and the job restoration as it relates to the PFML. And so they're going to be separate analysis, and there is the potential to stack. But if you have an employee that says, I am going to the state and I am getting my PFML, you can then run it concurrently with FMLA, assuming that it meets the conditions under both, that it's a serious health condition for a covered family member under both FMLA, PFML, you can then run them concurrently. And so you can't control the employee and force them to go to the state would be really the way to think about it in the start of it. Do you want to add?
I know we're running short on time. Are we all done here? Or are there any other questions, Angela, that you saw that you wanted to address?
Okay,
Oh, Kate's got one.
I could go all day. I love PFML. Another person wanted clarification on whether or not you can require an employee to use PTO during the 7-day waiting period before PFML benefits. I would like Jason to disagree with me if he wants to, but my recommendation is yes, you can absolutely require an employee to use PTO during the waiting period because they're not getting a PFML benefit during that week, so that's not considered supplemental benefits. It's PTO, and you as an employer get to control your own policies. Jason, do you want to disagree with me or agree with me?
I want to disagree with you, but I think as the law was written last year, I think PTO during the waiting period is going to be considered supplemental, which to your point is completely under the discretion of the employer. So I think you are correct. And I think there was just as this interplays with a previous question about whether or not leave taken on the waiting week counts. If you do claim hours of PFML during the waiting period, then yes, they will be reduced from your bank. But if you do end up taking paid time off for the entire week, then you did not really claim any hours of PFML from your bank that week. So your full entitlement to PFML will still be available to the employee if the employer does elect to require the employee to take PTO, or if the employee chooses to take PTO during that week, because essentially we're going to determine how many hours of PFML you're claiming each week. The department's going to take your typical work week hours, subtract hours worked in PTO, and that's going to be the number of hours you claim. The employee does not tell us how many hours they're claiming. We tell them based on data that we have collected and whatever happened that week. So if there are hours claimed, then yes, they will be reduced from their bank. If there are no hours claimed, then they won't be.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Jason. It looks like we are now out of time. We want to thank everyone for your great, thoughtful questions. As always, we're available to help as needed on PFML, and have a wonderful day. Get ready for January 1st.
Thank you. A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.
Are we all?